In our reading, we heard that pursuing happiness is far from self-indulgent, and in fact, that generally happy people are, quote, found to be more loving and forgiving than unhappy people. So for the moment, let's accept psychiatrist Howard Cutler and the Dalai Lama's premise. The purpose of our life is to seek happiness. Of course, there's no one definition of what makes folks happy. Many aphorisms speak to this. One person's meat is another person's poison. Different strokes for different folks, etc. So it might serve us to consciously decide and explore what's likely to bring us happiness and then shape our lives accordingly. About this, Dr. Martin Seligman, a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania and director of the Penn Positive Psychology Center, offers some guidance. He speaks of how for more than 70 years, the field of psychology has operated from a disease model. From this, it achieved two main victories. One, more than a dozen disorders once considered untreatable are now treatable. And two, along the way, a science developed, one able to measure and to some degree account for the causes of problems and to help manage them. This made many extremely miserable or troubled people less so, and of course, that's wonderful. But, says Dr. Seligman, the discipline often largely forgot about relatively untroubled people, so he developed what's now known as positive psychology, which says that the field should be just as concerned with people's strengths as their weaknesses, just as interested in building up the best things in life as in repairing the worst, just as involved with making the lives of more typical people happier and more fulfilling. The notion was powerful, and apparently the time was ripe, because in 1998, Dr. Seligman was elected president of the American Psychological Association by the largest margin ever. He tells of how he had studied extremely miserable people to find out how they differ from others, but now started looking at extremely happy people to find those differences. And he says the happiest people aren't more religious, they're not wealthier, not more attractive or in better shape, don't have more good events and fewer bad events happen to them, but they do have one key commonality. They are deeply bonded socially. For instance, most have a romantic partnership and a group of close friends. However, it's important to note that these factors are correlational, not necessarily causal. That is, the happiest people had partnerships and friends, but we can't say that those things caused them to be happier. He's talking about happiness here in the typical sense, like being cheerful, jovial, buoyant. But he also says, quote, that's not nearly enough. And Seligman and his colleagues began to look at therapeutic interventions over the centuries, as he put it, from the Buddha to Tony Robbins. About 120 techniques were proposed that supposedly make people happy. He studied these and found some were indeed effective in providing people with greater lasting happiness. And he summed these up in his first book on the subject, Learned Optimism. Here's a passage. Happiness is a scientifically unwieldy notion, but there are three different forms of it you can pursue. For the pleasant life, you aim to have as much positive emotion as possible and learn the skills to amplify positive emotion. For the engaged life, you identify your highest strengths and talents and recraft your life to use them as much as you can in work, love, friendship, parenting, and leisure. For the meaningful life, you use your highest strengths and talents to belong to and serve something you believe is larger than the self. So we're going to look at what Martin Seligman says about this trio, but first, one quick note. At times in our lives, we all have good reason to feel sad or heavy-hearted or frustrated and the like. So being happy doesn't mean ignoring or negating such feelings, nor closing down our empathy for others who are suffering. It means we acknowledge all these and more, which can often include unearthing and examining old hurts that can still haunt and hamper us. But we don't let these dominate our current emotional state, and thus block the benefits of happiness for ourselves and others. Even when trying to help right the world's many wrongs, mythologist Joseph Campbell wisely counsels us to participate joyfully in the sorrows of the world. So that said, let's check out more of what positive psychologist Martin Seligman says about each of these three happy lives. Again, the pleasant life, the engaged life, and the meaningful life. In the pleasant life, people pursue as much positive experience and emotion as possible. Sounds good, but it has two main limitations. One's positive emotional baseline is largely inborn, and applying external techniques can increase it only so much. And two, we rapidly become habituated to stimuli, however pleasurable. For example, think of discovering a new song or a new something that you really like. It's great, and it uplifts you. And then most times, we eventually tire of it, at least to some degree. And there's no real way around this ebbing of pleasure's initial intensity. It's just part of the human experience. Dr. Seligman's second happy life is the engaged life. Here our satisfactions are found in our career, parenting, relationship, leisure, etc. And common to these is entering a state of flow. It's been described elsewhere as, quote, a kind of intense focus and crisp sense of clarity where you forget yourself, lose track of time, and feel like you're part of something larger. Distinct from pleasure, which is highly sensory, in flow states we don't really sense anything, but become one with whatever we're engaged in. We can measure what skills are most likely to bring us into this state by identifying what Dr. Seligman terms our signature strengths, and then we shape our work, play, and relationships to enter this state as much as possible. To recap, the pleasant life comes from positive emotion, the engaged life from positive absorption. The final happy life is the meaningful life, aka the altruistic life. This starts where the engaged life does, knowing what your highest signature strengths are. But Seligman says then we use these to, quote, belong to and in the service of something larger than you are. Having identified these three lives, Martin Seligman then posed his overarching research question. To what extent does the pursuit of the pleasant life, the engaged life, and the meaningful life contribute to overall life satisfaction? The results show that the meaningful life is strongest, and the engaged life is also strong. But what surprised me is that the pleasant life, the one that pursues lots of positive emotions through experiences, which also happens to be what advertising is constantly selling us as the kind of life to be pursued and envied, yielded almost no long-term satisfaction. Dr. Seligman tells us that pleasure or positive emotions only bring satisfaction when meaning and engagement are already strong. Then he says, it's the whipped cream and the cherry. To test this, Seligman did an experiment where he had some people do something fun and then something altruistic and then reflect on the after effects. The results showed that after doing something fun, satisfaction drops quickly and stays flat. But when people do something to help someone or something else, the sense of satisfaction lasts and lasts. So, social science now confirms the spiritual maxim that it really is better to give than receive. Not only because it helps others, but because giving of ourselves to something beyond ourselves brings us deeper and more lasting happiness. Social science also confirms something else about happiness, which is that along with our individual psychology, a crucial factor is social context, the environments in which our psychologies and lives develop and exist. One examination of this is a National Geographic magazine cover story titled "The World's Happiest Places." In it, author Dan Buettner reports that the researchers who publish the World Happiness Report each year found that about 3/4 of human happiness is driven by social and cultural factors. And he writes here abridged by me, these factors don't materialize by chance. They are intimately related to a country's government and its cultural values. The happiest places incubate happiness for their people. In many cases, people thrive because the places where they live give them an invisible lift, constantly nudging them into behaviors that favor long-term well-being, unquote. This is why in his book, Happiness: Lessons from a New Science, and elsewhere, co-editor of that World Happiness Report, Richard Layard, a British economist and co-director of the Community Wellbeing Program at the London School of Economics, argues that the best public policies are those targeted at producing the most well-being for each government dollar spent. Considering this, a question came to mind. How might the USA look and feel different if its governmental leaders truly determined to give every citizen an invisible lift toward long-term well-being? What if our country focused on incubating gross national happiness over gross national product, now called gross domestic product? Do you think we would see some positive changes? I do. That's why in 2012, the General Assembly of the United Nations designated March 20th as the annual International Day of Happiness, which recognizes happiness as a universal human goal and affirms the need for social and economic policies designed to help end poverty, reduce inequality, and protect our planet through environmentally sustainable development. By the way, I discovered that there's a group called Gross National Happiness USA that you could look up if you're interested. I'm not kidding. So happiness has both external and internal factors. Let's return to the internal to close via the Art of Happiness book from our reading and what the Dalai Lama means when he talks about training this Tibetan SEM, S-E-M, the heart mind, for greater happiness. He encapsulates the essence this way, here abridged. There are many ways in which we actively contribute to our own experience of mental unrest and suffering. Although in general, mental and emotional afflictions themselves can come naturally, that is to say, stuff happens, often it is our own reinforcement of those negative emotions that makes them so much worse. We also often add to our pain and suffering by being overly sensitive, reacting to minor things, and sometimes taking things too personally. So I think that to a large extent, whether you suffer depends on how you respond to a given situation. In my experience, the Dalai Lama is spot on. Echoing the lens of consciousness concept I shared last week, our habitual internal interpretations, and many times misinterpretations, of events and of others, and our subsequent judgments and attitudes repeatedly determine our reality. Today I'll add our happiness, far more than most events themselves. Hence the Buddhist teaching, pain is inevitable, misery is optional. So let's not let our untrained heart minds rob us of our happiness. If you're troubled by something, question and check out your assumptions and conclusions. There might well be another perspective, another reality. And of course, there are exceptions, but as the Dalai Lama says, most things that bother us at first aren't personal or intentional or that big a deal. And as we train our heart minds for greater clarity and happiness, let's recall that, quote, it is unhappy people who tend to be the most self-focused and are often socially withdrawn, brooding, and even antagonistic. Happy people, in contrast, are generally found to be more sociable, flexible, and creative, and are able to tolerate life's daily frustrations more easily than unhappy people. And more importantly, they are found to be more loving and forgiving. Elizabeth Gilbert affirms this in her best-selling book, Eat, Pray, Love, where she writes, here again abridged, I keep remembering a simple idea a friend once told me, that all the sorrow and trouble in the world is caused by unhappy people. And in my own life, I can see exactly where my episodes of unhappiness have brought suffering or distress, or at the very least, inconvenience to those around me. The search for contentment is, therefore, not merely a self-preserving and self-benefiting act, but also a generous gift to the world. Clearing out all your misery, she says, gets you out of the way. You cease being an obstacle, not only to yourself, but to anyone else. Thank you, Sven. Putting all of this together now, the most constructive approach seems pretty clear to me. One, know that it's not only okay to be happy, but highly beneficial to all concerned. Two, understand that lasting happiness comes mostly from deep self-forgetting engagement and from helping others. And three, apply that altruism as much as we can to making society the grossest national happinessest habitat it can be. Finally, let's remember that we are all finite. How do we really want to spend our lives? The Dalai Lama's co-author Howard Cutler writes, "Our days are numbered. We never know. But whether we live a day or a century, a central question always remains. What is the purpose of our life? What makes our life meaningful?" For all the reasons just discussed, again, I offer the Dalai Lama's heartfelt answer. The purpose of our lives is to seek happiness. Namaste and blessed be.